This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Today on the program, stories about the Earth's fearsome creatures. Writer David Quammen joins us today to talk about his latest book, Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. At the outset of the book, David Quammen says he hopes the reader will contemplate the psychological, mythic, and spiritual dimensions, as well as the ecological implications of a particular sort of relationship, the predator-prey showdown between one dangerous, flesh-eating animal and one human victim. That relationship, says Quammen, has played a crucial role in shaping the way we humans construe our place in the natural world. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Give us a phone call. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in the U.S., use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. David Quammen is an award-winning author. He's the author of 6 books of nonfiction and 4 books of fiction. The awards he's received include an Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the National Magazine Award in Essays and Criticism. His new book, Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind, is published by Norton. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. David Quammen, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be with you again.
Sure. The idea of for this book came to you while you were visiting a forest in India inhabited by lions. Lions in India?
Right. Usually you say India, people think tigers.
Right.
But the fact is there survives in one little forest in western India 300 lions, which represents the last wild population of a subspecies of lion that used to exist all across southwestern Asia. It's called the Asiatic lion, Panthera leo persica.
And how is that lion different from the African lion?
Well, it looks almost identical. If you're not an expert, you'd see one of these lions and you would not be able to distinguish it from an African lion. The experts can tell on the basis of small differences of cell structure or skull structure and a little bit in the way of external characteristics, but subtle things. These lions probably are at somewhere between 50,000 and 200,000 years of genetic difference distance from the last interbreeding contact through Western Asia with African lions. So they're different from African lions, but not different enough to be considered a distinct species.
Okay, so they're as big and fearsome as their African cousins.
Well, they are, although they're a little bit more calm. The time I spent in the Gir Forest, it's called the Gir Forest in Western India, the time I spent there was mostly with an Indian biologist named Dr. Ravi Chellam. And he and I and a local tracker would approach to within 30 or 40 feet of a lion. Even at one point, a female lion who was nursing 3 kits, she knew we were there. She and her children were feeding intermittently off of a deer carcass. She was letting them nurse, as I say. And she was very relaxed about the fact that there were these human figures just a stone's throw away.
Yeah.
You can't do that with African lions.
No. I don't even know if I'd like to do it with an Asiatic lion, to tell you the truth.
Well, we were pretty careful about it, and the tracker was reading the subtle signals of posture and mood from her as we stood there.
Yeah. I want to come back to the Asiatic lion and the Gir Forest, but before that, I want to ask you some kind of background questions. First of all, I want to know how it was that you began to contemplate this relationship between human beings and the Earth's man-eaters.
Well, the seed was planted even before my first trip to the Gir Forest in India. Back in 1992, I went to the island of Komodo in Indonesia to look at Komodo dragons, the big flesh-eating giant lizard that lives on the island of Komodo. This was in connection with the book I was writing at the time about evolution and extinction on islands, which eventually appeared as the Song of the Dodo. Mm-hmm. And the main question for me then was, why did these lizards become gigantized? They're as big as crocodiles, but they are true lizards, and they're terrestrial, and they eat deer, wild boar, horses, anything that they can catch, and occasionally they attack a human. While I was there, I talked with some of the local people who had had relatives attacked by Komodo dragons, and I got very interested in the situation of local people, rural people, people who live close to the soil, living in big predator habitat, and what the psychological dimension of that was like for them. And so, as I say, that seed was planted, and then I came back to that question of the perspective of the local people 5 or 6 years later when I saw the lions at Gear, and the whole book project grew out of that.
Mm. Well, besides the lions, who else are the Earth's man-eaters, the creatures you call alpha predators?
Right. I've given them that label, alpha predators. It's not a scientific category, but it's a psychological category that has, I think, significance. I say alpha predators and not just big predators because I'm talking about solitary species that are big enough, fierce enough, solitary enough, such that a single individual can and sometimes does kill and eat a human. So that doesn't include wolves, doesn't include jackals or hyenas or piranha, but it does include lions, tigers, saltwater crocodile, Nile crocodile in Africa, polar bear, the brown bear, which includes the grizzly bear, the leopard, the great white shark, and just a handful of others, maybe a dozen more. It's a short but very, very distinguished list of species.
Yeah. I began my introduction this afternoon with a line from The Wizard of Oz, "Lions and tigers and bears, oh my." Of course, one of the heroes of the story is a lion. But anyway, these alpha predators show up in all kinds of stories, don't they?
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the things I examine in the book, is not just their presence on the landscape, but their presence in the human psyche. They're mythic, they're spiritual, their aesthetic importance to humans, to our species, down through the centuries, down through the millennia. It goes back a long way. You can find evidence in art, scripture, and literature that we have had a very strong psychological relationship with these creatures. I look at, for instance, the old English poem Beowulf about a Scandinavian warlord, Beowulf, who fights against essentially a man-eating predator named Grendel. Other epic literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and contains another instance of that, the battle of the hero versus the beast, the story of St. George and the dragon, and a number of others in myth, epic literature, and scripture. In the book of Job of the Old Testament, there is the figure of Leviathan, which is not a whale. We tend to think of Leviathan as a whale nowadays, but Leviathan of the Old Testament was a fire-breathing, very toothy, scaled sort of sea monster, kind of a cross between a sea dragon and a saltwater crocodile, that the Lord refers to when he is reminding Job it's important for Job and for humans, by extension, to remain humble in the face not just of the Almighty Lord, but of the things that he's created.
Mm. Across cultures, are the stories similar?
There is some similarity across cultures, both in terms of the kinds of stories that are told, the ways people have invented for coping with these big predators. For instance, the whole matter, as I said, of the story of the hero versus the monster. That reappears in culture after culture, literary source after literary source. It seems to have been important for the great kingly hero to test himself, and usually it was a him and not a her, to test himself against either against man-eating beasts of the real sort, like the lions that Daniel faces in the Old Testament, that King David faced when he was a young shepherd, or against monstrous figures that seem to have been concocted from combinations of the imagination and these real creatures living on the landscape. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of similarity in that particular type of story, the hero versus monster narrative.
Yeah. What would be an example of a story that would deviate from the kinds of stories that we're familiar with, that kind of story, for example? What are some of the more unusual, or what is an example of a more unusual kind of story involving humans and predator animals?
Well, one of the places that I visited researching the book was the Northern Territory of Australia, in particular an Aboriginal reserve in a very remote corner of the Northern Territory of Australia. This place is called Arnhem Land, and it includes several different Aboriginal cultures, one of which is the Yolngu culture of northeastern Arnhem Land. And the Yolngu venerate the saltwater crocodile as a godlike creature that they call Baru, B-A-R-U, also known as the ancestral crocodile. So the crocodile for the Yolngu people is a large, mythic figure that is one of their ancestors, is one of the godlike creatures that owned the earth, that participated in creating the earth, the landscape that the Yolngu know, and in which they continue to venerate. Some of the clans of the Yolngu have the saltwater crocodile as their totemic animal, meaning they have a particularly close association with it. That totemic association dictates the way they can behave in regard to living physical saltwater crocodiles. So it's a very rich, complicated, and essentially respectful and not fearful relationship with the saltwater croc.
You know, once upon a time, human beings were very much in danger of being a meal for a flesh-eating animal. It was kind of a daily kind of a threat, I suppose. But, you know, other than taking precautions so as not to attract a bear's attention while I'm hiking in bear territory, alpha predators are not something I've had to worry about coming face-to-face with. Why, then, does someone like myself continue to enjoy stories about these creatures?
Well, that's a good question. It's one of the mysteries that I try to explore in this book. Ultimately, there's no answer. These animals are fearsome, but they're also big, exciting, beautiful, imposing. And my belief is that we need them. We need them to enliven our nightmares. We need them to enliven our stories, our horror stories, our stories of heroism. A much more recent form of art, for instance, popular art that incorporates man-eating predators, is the Alien series movie starring Sigourney Weaver. I talk about those in the book. Those creatures scare us, they horrify us in those movies, and yet they allow humans, in particular Ellen Ripley, Lieutenant Ellen Ripley, the character that Sigourney Weaver plays, to manifest courage, leadership, stout-heartedness, very, very human fear. And they represent something larger and more interesting, more thrilling, more exciting than the mere mundane physical world that that we see and that we live in. So I think that if we lose these species and populations of big predator all over the world, the way we seem destined to do, given current trends, then we'll lose more than their scientific role, their ecological importance within natural communities. That'll be important, but there'll be another sort of loss, another dimension of loss in the spiritual and the psychological realm. We'll find that we're living on a planet that's uglier, more boring, more lonely, more tedious for the absence of big predators than the one that our ancestors lived on.
Yeah. Would you go so far as to say we might lose our place?
I think we'll lose our sense of our place. And it's something else that I explore in the book. I think that these creatures, because they occasionally have preyed on humans, have been a very vivid reminder to us that we're part of the natural world, that we're part of a food chain, that we're just another flavor of meat. That's been important as we humans have come to understand our role in the world, for us to be reminded that we are part of a food chain. We are part of nature. We're not separate from nature. We're not above nature. We're within nature because we're preyed upon by beasts larger than us occasionally. And when those beasts disappear, I'm afraid that it's going to liberate us into sort of a prideful psychic irresponsibility, even more severe than the sort of irresponsibility that we exercise now in our wasteful transformations and uses of the natural resources of the planet.
Mm. Writer David Quammen is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his latest book, Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion with questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I'm very sympathetic to your view of our need for these animals. On the other hand, as you write in this book, you say, well, what about the argument a hard-headed humanist might make? And in fact, can one, you know, justify the suffering of some folks and the difficulties they face as a result of living in close proximity to lions or crocodiles or bears?
Right. I think it's very important for us to remember and understand what it's like for those native people, those rural people, those livestock raisers who live on the landscape in habitat, in intimate relationship with these big predators. It's easy for we people who live in cities on the other side of the world to say that, oh, it's very important to preserve the tiger, the Siberian tiger, the tiger in India. It's very important that we save the Asiatic lion. At a distance, we can enjoy the thrill of knowing that those species exist, but we need to remember that big, dangerous predators are expensive, are inconvenient, are costly to somebody. Who pays the cost? Mostly, it's the poor rural people who live on the landscape in their habitat. So we need to, as a society, as a world society, we need to find ways to redistribute the costs as well as the benefits of the continued existence of big predators. We need to find ways to share the costs, the undeniable costs of those big, inconvenient, dangerous animals with the people like the Yolngu in Australia, like the people who live in the Gir Forest, who are on the firing line, who feel the threat and the cost of those predators in their daily lives.
Yeah, there's a chilling account of a people eating crocodile in the book. But this crocodile really doesn't come to the attention of anybody outside of the folks that live around this area of Ethiopia until an American is killed by it. The people in that part of Ethiopia, the Turkana, how do they view the crocs? How do they live with them?
Well, around in Ethiopia and in northern Kenya, around Lake Turkana, there is a large population of Nile crocodile, and the Turkana people live in that area. Some of them live in fishing villages along the shore of the lake, and they seem to view the crocodile not as a benign god, but as sort of a menacing godly presence or almost a demonic presence who performs murderous acts on humans in most cases when they deserve it. So if a Turkana person is taken by a Nile crocodile, then people seem to start to assume that, well, that fellow must have done something bad. He must have gotten crosswise with the powers that be. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been eaten by that crocodile. So they have a very dark, vision, incorporating crocodile predation into their belief system, but in a way that almost puts a bit of guilt, retroactive guilt, on the victim.
Hmm. Where they exist, are crocodiles protected? Are they managed?
They are. There's about 22, 23 different species of crocodilian, which includes alligators as well as crocodiles, in the world. Some of those are very severely endangered and are protected by national and international statutes, international treaties, for instance, like the CITES Treaty against international trade in animal parts protects some of them. The two that I write about mainly in the book are the Nile crocodile in Africa and the saltwater crocodile in Australia and southeastern Asia. And the saltwater crocodile was very heavily hunted in the 40s, 50s, into the 60s for its skin, because saltwater crocodile produces the most desirable form of crocodile leather. So if you see a Gucci handbag for $15,000 or something crazy like that, the chances are it's made from a saltwater crocodile skin. They were heavily hunted because of that sort of market demand. And then the Northern Territory government and the government of Australia put protection on them in the early 70s, and the saltwater crocodile has bounced back quite well because its habitat was still in good shape and because, as a species, it reproduces fairly quickly. A saltwater crocodile female lays a clutch of about 50 eggs about once a year. So they've bounced back, and now there is some limited harvest of saltwater crocodiles allowed, and there is domestic rearing of saltwater crocodiles for their skin, and the wild populations are in fairly good shape, at least in Australia so far, and they'll stay that way probably as long as the habitat isn't destroyed.
Hmm. Have you seen The Crocodile Hunter, the TV show?
I never have. I've heard about that crazy guy. People have said, oh, you've got to see The Crocodile Hunter. What's his name, Steve Irwin?
Steve Irwin, yeah. He's the director of the Australia Zoo.
Yeah, and I've never crossed paths with him or seen his show.
Yeah, he's been involved in moving saltwater crocs to areas where they're less likely to be a problem mm-hmm. for people. And he's been at that since the 1970s. And the show is fun to watch. It's pretty amazing. He's a pretty crazy guy. So the situation of the salty today in Australia is pretty good.
It is, but there are still places, and this may be what Steve Irwin has been partly involved with, there are places where the saltwater croc would like to live, but it's unwelcome. For instance, in the harbor of the city of Darwin, which is the largest city, the capital city of the Northern Territory on the north coast. Darwin is a very, very interesting city. It's a thriving tourist town. It's got a very large, nice harbor, and there are employees of, I think it's the Northern Territory Conservation Commission, who are charged with going out in the harbor and trapping big crocodiles and moving them out of there. I went out with some of these fellows too. At one point we brought in a big croc, probably a 13 or 14 footer, inside one of these steel traps, then he was, as I recall, he was given to one of the crocodile farms to become a breeder for them. But you can move crocodiles all day long, all year long, but as long as there is good habitat for them, the chances are that's just going to be a vacuum that nature refills with a new crocodile coming in.
Mm.
But it's almost a political public relations thing for the Conservation Commission. People want to know that they're doing something about it. So they trap crocodiles and move them, but even they seem to know that they're not going to exterminate crocodiles from Darwin Harbor.
Hmm. One of the many interesting characters you write about in Monster of God is one Andrew Capo, a pickler of salties for bikies.
Yeah.
Tell us about him.
Andrew is a great fellow. He's a taxidermist. He's a professional taxidermist. He was trained in museum taxidermy at the Northern Territory Museum in Darwin. And then because he's kind of a free spirit, he decided to go out on his own. He now lives in a little bush compound outside of Darwin, where I visited him. It's really just a metal roof over a concrete slab with a bunch of tools, a bed, and a freezer filled with projects filled with dead fish and crocodile skulls that he's supposed to turn into taxidermied artifacts. And he does a lot of a fish for fishermen, stuffing a fish, mounting a fish. That's his bread and butter. But he also has become the favorite taxidermist of Hell's Angels in Australia. And they bring him, they commission him to pickle crocodile skulls to be given to various different Hell's Angel clubhouses and chapters around Australia as what? I don't know, as decorations, as tokens, as mementos, as items of interior decoration. So when I talked to him, he was just in the process of working on a huge crocodile skull. This thing was about, just the skull was about 4 feet long and probably weighed 60 or 70 pounds. He pulled it out of his freezer. It was frozen, but it already had started to rot because the crocodile had spent a little bit too much time dead in the sun before Andrew got to it. And his job then was to turn that into a nicely pickled crocodile skull for Hell's Angels.
Yeah, somewhat reminiscent of the big game trophies of years ago.
Yeah, in a way, with sort of a special dark,
weird twist.
Whimsical twist to it, right.
Now, why did you choose to write about pickled croc heads for Monster of God?
Well, because I was interested in the commercial relationship between humans and these species, as well as the ecological and the psychic relationship, and because, frankly, it's a very serious book, almost a gloomy book in certain ways, but I also want it to be an entertaining book, a good read. And Andrew is a great character, and it was just fun to visit him and listen to his elaborately expert description of how you pickle a crocodile skull. So I put it in simply because it's a good story.
Yeah. Is there room in conservation for commerce or for some hunting for sustenance, for sustaining populations of folks, or for use in rituals?
There certainly is some room. Some experts would argue that you'll never save any species of large animal unless you put a price tag on its head for harvest. There's a crocodile expert in Australia who makes exactly that argument. He's had a lot of dealings with the saltwater crocodile and with crocodilians around the world, and he believes in sustainable exploitation as the way to save these species. He says it's worked with the saltwater crocodile. We are now selling crocodile hide again. There's great demand for crocodile meat. There's a commercial value to the species, and as long as there's a commercial value to it, its habitat will be preserved because there will be value to that. When you take away the commercial value, then you have only laws and people's goodwill to protect the species, and you don't also have material incentive, and he believes that that will doom an animal. So he even goes so far as to say, if you've got only 300 individuals of the Siberian tiger, then you should sell the right or the privilege of killing three or four a year to rich hunters, and give the money that earns to the local people as an incentive to them not to poach the tiger and to preserve the tiger's habitat. Other conservationists, including the people who work with Siberian tigers, say, no, that might work with saltwater crocodiles, which reproduce quickly and which don't share most of their habitat with humans. They only share the riverbanks. But it doesn't work as well with big cats and should not be used as a strategy with the conservation, for instance, of tigers or lions. It's a lively debate. It's a complicated debate. I'm not absolutely sure where I come down on it myself. I find it distasteful to think about people shooting Siberian tigers for sport, but to say that it's distasteful is different from saying that it might not be our last resort. It might not work.
Mm. Well, besides the commercial offtake, what else would a successful approach to conserving animals entail, if that's part of the picture? What else is involved in conserving these animals and doing a successful job of it?
Well, it's a complicated question, and it tends to have particular answers around the world in particular places. But a few general things can be said. One is that the point of conflict between big predators and humans in most cases is livestock. It's not just people in the habitat. It's people with sheep, cows, domestic buffalo, goats, whatever. And when people are there and people are displacing the native herbivores, the deer, the antelope, the bison, whatever, with their own livestock, then the big predators really have no choice but to begin to prey on the livestock that have supplanted their natural prey. So that's where the conflict comes. The ways of dealing with that differ from place to place, but they need to involve ways of minimizing that conflict between big predators and livestock and redistributing, as I said earlier, the costs of the big predators. So, for instance, in the northern Rockies, there are bear, there are mountain lion, and in the Yellowstone ecosystem recently, wolves have been reintroduced. Again, wolves I don't include among the alpha predators, but there is a conflict between them and sheep, livestock. And the organization Defenders of Wildlife has established a privately funded compensation fund to pay ranchers back for any livestock losses that they've suffered because of wolf predation. That's one very practical way of redistributing those costs.
Yeah. Well, this brings me back to now to the Asiatic lion in India, because this Asiatic lion, what you said, is not as ferocious as the African lion in terms of attacking people, but it is a threat to livestock that are managed and raised by the Muldharis.
Right.
These are Indians who live in the refuge in the Gir Forest.
Right.
How do they feel about the lions?
The Muldharis have a very philosophical attitude toward the lions in most cases. They're a livestock-raising people. They're very old-fashioned, traditional, in the sense that Amish people or Hutterite people are traditional. They live by choice a simpler life separated from modern technology and modern culture. In this case, the Muldhari pasture domestic buffalo and cows in the forest among the lions. They milk the cows and the buffalo and market the dairy products that they take from those. And they don't carry guns. They carry only these small, sort of short-handled axes that they call a kawati. It's really not much more than a nine iron, and that's their defense against the lion. And when lions come to prey on their buffalo or their cows, it's the job of the Muldhari herder to clunk the lion on the head with this little short-handled axe and drive it away. And that's why they occasionally themselves get attacked, injured by lions.
Hmm.
I talked with a number of these folks, Muldharis, and they tended, as I say, to be philosophical. One fellow told me, well, there's danger in all parts of life. If it's going to get you, it'll get you. Another fellow told me about the lion, well, there's nothing wrong with the animal. The animal is good. This is a fellow who had been attacked twice and badly injured both times while he was defending his buffalo from lion attack. And yet he seemed to feel that, well, that's part of the bargain. That's part of life. There are dangers in life, and there are particular dangers to life in the forest. But he wanted to live his life in the forest with his cows, with his buffalo, with the wild peacocks, with the dust and the smell of the monsoon rains. He did not want to live in the city of Bombay. He did not want to live in the village, and so he accepted those dangers and costs.
Yeah. Well, we in the civilization that we live in, we also accept risks and are philosophical about them as well. I mean, in terms of getting into the automobile, using your credit card on the internet, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, well, it's part of life.
Right. And this is a subject that interests me. People have tastes in risk. Everybody accepts certain kinds of risk, and everybody finds other kinds of risks distasteful or intolerable. And it's not a matter of the size of the risk. It's a matter, I think of it as the flavor of the risk. For instance, ranchers in the northern Rockies might find it intolerable that there be any risk that their livestock are killed by big predators. They want the government to deal with these grizzly bears, deal with these wolves, so that they don't have the risk of losing stock to them. And yet the same person might be perfectly happy to accept the risk of driving a Ford pickup at 70 miles an hour down a dirt road not wearing a seatbelt.
Right, or, with a long-neck beer in one hand.
Not to stereotype these folks too much, but there are,
There are folks like that, yeah.
There are folks like that, yeah. Not every rancher, but there are. Or they might, they might smoke Marlboros or use chewing tobacco. There are risks, and they know there are risks to those, but they don't mind that kind of risk. They accept that flavor of risk. Whereas you might find environmentalists, conservationists, greens, who will say, well, I find intolerable the idea of the risk of living downwind from a nuclear power plant. I find intolerable the risk of secondary cigarette smoke in a restaurant. But when I go out and walk in the forest and there's a grizzly bear population there, I find that risk acceptable. That flavor of risk suits me fine. So this is a human thing. Nobody is completely wrong or completely right about that. It really puzzles me, and it fascinates me that people have their tastes and risks. They'll accept this, but not that, and other people are just the opposite.
Yeah. For the lions of the Gir, or for the lions of that part of India, and for the Muldaris, there have been great changes over the course of a relatively brief period of time. I mean, really brief when you think about it, 30, 40 years.
Right.
And one of the Muldari that you met and talked with was a very interesting fellow by the name of Kimadula Rabari, a man in his 70s. What did he have to tell you? What kind of changes has he seen in his life?
This was the fellow that lived in one of these little Muldari encampments on the very edge of the Gir Forest. And he now had electricity. He had an elderly wife, and he had a new young wife. He had taken a second wife because his first wife and he had not been able to have any children. He took a second wife, and she had started to produce children. He was happy about that. He was happy about having electricity. He was happy about living next to a road by which he could market his dairy products. And he seemed to be one of those Muldaris who was ready to accept change. Other Muldaris were very much more traditional than him. And part of what Kimadula represented to me was the fact that you can't generalize too much about any group of people. You can't say, well, native people, indigenous people are philosophical about big predators. They've learned to live with big predators. They've learned to live in these very, very simplified material circumstances. They don't want modern technology. Some of them don't. Some of them do. Mm-hmm. Some of them are philosophical. Some of them are angry. Some of them say, well, the lion is a good animal. I accept that as part of the forest. And others say, no, I don't like these lions. Somebody should get rid of them. You know, relieve us of the burden of these flesh-eating beasts. I found that with the people in Romania the shepherds in the highlands of Romania who share their habitat with brown bear. Mm-hmm. I found that among the Australian people, the Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory who live among crocodiles, a diversity of voices.
Yeah. Time is growing short here this afternoon. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about the bears of Romania. This was a fascinating chapter in the book.
Yeah, this was something that came as a surprise to me myself when I began researching the book. I read somewhere that the Carpathian Mountains in Romania now contain more than 5,000 brown bear. That's the species Ursus arctos, same species as the grizzly bear. 5,000 brown bear is a lot of brown bear in a country that most of us would think of, if we thought of it at all, as blighted, industrialized, post-communist Eastern Bloc country. Well, it is that. It is a struggling post-communist country with a lot of industrialism in certain parts, but it also has these beautiful Carpathian Mountains covered with oak and beech forest and filled with brown bear, more than 5,000 brown bear, which is at least 10 times the population of brown bear in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem in roughly the same area. And we think of Yellowstone as one of the great bear sanctuaries in the world, but Romania, of all places, more than 5,000 brown bear. So I started going there to try and find an answer to the question, why does this place have so many brown bear? And the answer is, again, complicated, but it involves the fact that the habitat is very good, that the Romanian Forest Department puts a lot of supplemental food into the habitat, essentially farming bears for sport hunting.
Mm-hmm.
They put hundreds and hundreds of pounds of apples and plums and corn cobs and bear chow into the forest to supplement the food of these bears so that they'll reproduce more quickly and grow larger so that they can sell the right to hunt them to wealthy foreign hunters.
Yeah, or prominent politicians.
Or prominent politicians, and that's the other part of that story. The dictator of Romania for 25 years, Nicolae Ceaușescu, came to fancy himself a great bear hunter. So for most of his reign, he allowed no one else to hunt the bears of Romania. He killed far more bears than any single person ever should, but he let no one else, or almost no one else, kill any of them. And that, as perverse as it was, that provided a sort of net protection to the bear population that allowed them at one point to increase to the point of 8,000 bears.
Mm.
And then he fell. He was deposed and killed in 1989. And at that point, the bears of Romania became a free enterprise export product.
Mm. Well, the bears in Romania are doing pretty well in terms of their numbers. They're still hunted, but and the salties in Australia, although they're still a vulnerable population, the saltwater crocs, they seem to be doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But the lions and the gir, they don't sound like they're doing real well.
The lions and gir are not doing well enough. No, the area is too small. There aren't enough of them. Their gene pool is too small. They're isolated in this little forest, and they could be wiped out at any time by, for instance, a viral disease that might be brought in. They're very vulnerable. Likewise, the Siberian tiger in the mountains of the Russian Far East are down to about 300 individuals. There are good conservation measures being applied there, but again, 300 is not very many. And in most cases around the world, these big predators are isolated on smallish fragments of habitat in populations or subpopulations that don't have enough genetic diversity, and are jeopardized by the continuing encroachment of human sprawl into their habitat. So I'm very concerned about whether or not any of these creatures will survive in the wild 150 or 200 years from now.
Yeah, it also sounds like that genetic diversity issue is very important. So even if we had some of these animals surviving in captivity, or they're not going to be doing very well long term because of that issue of genetic diversity.
That's right. Particularly, well, their survival in captivity is almost another question itself. They may survive in zoos. Their DNA may survive in test tubes, but allowing them to survive in the wild is much more important and much more difficult. And one of the things that they need are large areas of protected habitat, large enough to support not just a population of 50 or 100 big predators, but a population in the high hundreds or into the thousands, to give them sufficient genetic diversity to survive disease and climatic change and the other things that buffet a population of wild animals. They need genetic diversity in order to cope with crises and with change. And when we isolate them in tiny little reserves with only a few dozen here and a few dozen there, they lose that genetic diversity.
Mm. Are you hopeful about their prospects?
Given current trends, I have to say no, I'm not hopeful.
No.
And I don't believe in preaching gloom or doom, but I believe in calling it as you see it. And as I see it right now, with human population continuing to increase and with human consumption continuing to increase, I see the habitat for these big predators continuing to shrink to a point where maybe 150 years from now, there are none of them surviving in the wild. And I think that will be a huge loss not just in biological terms, but in psychological terms, for our species as well as for the planet as a whole.
Mm. There we have to leave it. David Quammen, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're welcome, Celeste. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
David Quammen's latest book is Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. The book is published by Norton.